it's our strength that is going to be challenged.
So just so to say psychological reasons,
exactly,
they need.
That's one of the dimensions that I feel it has also a role to play in these sanctions to be taken
because
off.
Usually when America says no, people say okay.
Exactly.
Right? And then if America's saying no, and somebody just be like...
And do you know one thing really interesting to go off of your point? Ansarullah celebrated after they were put on the sanctions list. They were put on this terrorist list and they celebrated. Why? Because they are defining it to be a source of pride for them instead of a source of, you know, nung and ar and shamefulness, right? Yeah. So they said that this is something which we are proud of, that the great Satan has put us on a sanctions list. You know, this means we are the party of Allah. We are the ones who are the group of Allah, the party of Allah, who is struggling in His way for justice, for that human values that every nation looks forward to. What do you know about Yemen, right? If you look at last 6 years at least, you know, Yemen is known to be that hub of resistance against the Saudi and US-led wars in the region, especially on Yemen, right? Yeah. So they have been resisting. Like I said before, Saudi and America, in their calculation, it was only going to be a matter of few days before Yemen falls. Before the resistance movement there just gives up, you know, they kneel down and they start like bowing in front of America and Saudis the way they wish to. Turned out, no. These people, these dignified people, the nation, and it's not just a group when we say Ansarullah, it's like a widespread phenomena in Yemen, you know, it's every other person is Ansarullah, right?
Yeah.
They
right.
stood tall, they resisted against the oppression, they resisted to make sure, and if you look at the speeches of Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who is the leader of the Ansarullah movement, you look at his speeches, it is so beautiful. He's reciting Quran and he's like, you know, we are the misdaq of this verse of Quran. We are going to stand in front of the oppressors. We're not going to give in to the oppressors. Even if we are completely annihilated, we are not going to let this history be made that the nations, they give in to the whims and wishes of the great Satan and, you know, regimes, rogue regimes like Saudi Arabia. So alhamdulillah, you know, it's resistance and their whole slogans, you know, it starts with Allahu Akbar, you know, and it ends with, you know, with the death of the Zionists, right? Yeah. So alhamdulillah, you know, it's a resistance that is standing tall. It's not just a nation, it's not just a country. And they're paying a price for that resistance.
They are.
Right? It's nothing else. It's for that resistance.
I want to bring it back.
Before we do, see, so this resistance that we're talking about here, one of the things that we have to factor in here is that these are people, you know, the Ansarullah movement, who represents a large majority of the Yemeni people, is conducting this movement or this resistance in order for their voices to be heard, right? So what I'm saying is that during the time of Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was put in there by the colonial powers, and then this second guy, he's got a weird name. I keep on messing it up, but this guy, Mansur Rabi something. So this guy, who was the one who fled to Saudi Arabia, and then Saudi Arabia did this war in order to try to bring him back, right? This guy was taken out during when? During the Arab Spring, the Islamic Spring. Mm-hmm. When the Islamic Spring happened, the Houthis and the Ansarullah movement and a large majority of the Yemeni people stood up for their democratic rights, which had been, you know, they had been under oppression during this guy, Abu Mansur, and Ali Abdullah Saleh.
Yeah.
Okay? So when these guys stood up for their rights, their self-determination, their democracy, this is when the Americans and the Saudis and all these guys put them down.
Wow. So, okay? I'm having a bit of deja vu here. So we've seen this happen before. This kind of revolution against a puppet dictator, we saw it happen in 1979 in Iran, right? So these people of Iran, they rose up and they overthrew the dictator. What was the next move that America made? It supported Saddam Hussein to attack Iran. And then after years of fighting with Iran, they failed to overcome Iran, and then America invaded Iraq. So I'm coming right back to the original question here, because I wanted to throw that at Sheikh Ali and see what he has to say about it. Is this something similar that we're seeing now? Because the people of Yemen have now risen up. They have also overthrown their dictator. America has done the same thing, backing not Saddam Hussein this time, but the Saudi regime to attack them. And they're also failing. So when they prove that they have no power against the Yemenis, is America going to invade Saudi Arabia?
Well, I'll come to the Saudi Arabia part at the end, but trust me, it's the same execution strategy that the West always has.
And fails.
It is,
it's so beautiful.
It always fails, right? With the the camp of resistance always fails. It is the strategy of carrot and stick. They tried to use a stick against Yemenis to crush them, you know, because it's a quicker way, you know. Simply, it's just easier, it's quicker, and it's less consuming.
They saw the Yemenis had a bigger stick than they did.
It turned out that Yemenis, you know, gave them a proper pushback, right? Yeah. And they're not backing off from their dignified stance. Now, Trump goes, Biden comes in, they have a new strategy that we are going to go to the route of diplomacy. And in order for you to be in diplomatic terms with a country's main representative body, in this case, Ansarullah, they can't be on a terrorist list. You can't really negotiate. So I think where it's headed, and we will see as things unfold, I think they're going to take it towards diplomacy. And what they're going to do there is, okay, you've got a humanitarian crisis. You don't have clean water. You don't have medicines. You don't have, your crops are gone. Your buildings are, your infrastructure is, you know. Okay, we will build it all for you. We will come help you. We'll provide you. United Nations will come in. You know, we'll provide you with medicines. We'll provide you with all this stuff. You know, let's sit down, have a talk. And we'll give you cash to run the country, right? We'll give you money. You know, we'll help you get the oil thing at your disposal so you can export. You know, we'll give you all these facilities. We will, in other words, facilitate you, uplift you, right? For what? For giving up on your revolutionary and the stance of resistance and coming out of the camp of resistance, which is led by the Islamic Republic of Iran and Wilaya. They want them to just leave that camp. First they tried the stick, now they're going to try the carrot. But let me assure you, as much as I have studied Yemenis and as much as I know about them, they don't stand a chance to have any victory in this diplomatic negotiations either, if they go down that route.
That's all we have time for today. We hope you enjoyed and benefited from the show. Inshallah, we'll see you next time. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please, don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
European News Bulletin.
Here in London, news with me, Saeed Bourza. A major development in this country today, and that has to do with the Supreme Court that has ruled that Shamima Begum, a 21-year-old woman who left the UK for Syria 6 years ago to join Daesh, should not be allowed back into the country to pursue an appeal against the removal of her British citizenship. Many argue that refusing to repatriate her could backfire, but the government insists she is a security risk. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
In July 2020, the Court of Appeal ruled that Shamima Begum should be allowed to return to the UK to challenge her citizenship being revoked, saying it was, quote, the only way in which she can have a fair and effective appeal. But in November, the Home Office appealed against the decision, arguing it would create significant national security risks. Now the Supreme Court has ruled in the Home Office's favour, saying the right to a fair hearing does not trump other considerations.
The appropriate response to the problem in the present case is for the deprivation appeal to be stayed or postponed until Ms. Begum is in a position to play an effective part in it without public safety being compromised. That is not a perfect solution, as it's not known how long it may be before that is possible. But there is no perfect solution to our dilemma at the present time.
In February 2015, at the age of 15, Shamima Begum left the UK for Syria. She was then found in 2019 in a Syrian refugee camp with other women and their children. The interviews that she gave made headline news and sparked heated debates. In what many called a publicity stunt, then Home Secretary Sajid Javid stripped Ms. Begum of her citizenship. Before the latest ruling, four British MPs wrote in the Telegraph that leaving British Daesh members in an ungoverned space would backfire on the UK.
If they are judged to be a risk, then all the more reason why they should be returned to Britain, where they can be processed by the British criminal justice system. Many of the people involved travelled to Syria as teenagers after being groomed online or trafficked by organised ISIS gangs.
France has outsourced its Daesh members' prosecutions to Iraq, where they have been given death sentences. The UK, the US, Ireland and Australia have stripped the accused of their citizenships. According to the Middle East Institute, this might be fueling future terrorist activity by sending the message that they are second-class citizens, particularly those with immigrant backgrounds. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, let's discuss that story with Ahmed Caballo. Ahmed, good to have you. So, what do you make of this decision made by the Supreme Court, which essentially, as we heard in our report, upholds the Home Office's argument that allowing her to return to the UK would, quote, create significant national security risk?
Yeah, it's worrying and it sets a dangerous precedent, because the decision today wasn't about her British citizenship per se, but more about the right to a fair trial. Because they claim in the UK that the right to a fair trial is a cornerstone of any democracy, and something the UK lambasts other nations around the world about. Yet the Supreme Court decided to overturn the Court of Appeal and said that the only way forward was to allow her to have her case while being in a refugee camp in northern Syria. Now, no one could argue that she could rightfully defend herself or appropriately defend herself from a refugee camp, which is most likely still controlled by the same elements that she was that she joined in the first place. Now, what's interesting about the decision is that it claims to be about national security, but if Shamim Begum returned to the UK, then she would most likely be monitored, she would be under house arrest, she'd be intensely watched, she'd have limited visitation rights. So in my opinion, it wasn't really about national security, but a political decision, because there was very little appetite to allow her back into the UK. And the other real issue is that because of the relatively low conviction rate for fighters and their spouses who return to the UK, because the defence who represent these fighters are able to argue that the groups that these fighters join were also part of the same groups that have been supported by the British state itself, and therefore it wouldn't make sense to convict these fighters of crimes or fighting on behalf of a cause that the British state itself has supported.
All right, I mean, let's bring in race and ethnicity into the conversation as well. What role, if any, do you think those two facts, if you will, have played in the way that Shamima Begum has been treated by the government here?
I think it's played a massive role, because if you're a British citizen from an ethnic minority background here in the UK, there is this perception that your citizenship is conditional, and that if you criticise the British state, criticise British foreign policy, criticised British domestic policies such as policing, stop and search, then a common response is, why don't you go back to where you came from, negating the fact that if you are born in the UK, you are a British citizen. And I think this underpins the Shamim Begum case, because the idea is her citizenship was conditional, and therefore when she did something that the British public and British MPs and the British Home Office didn't like, then she no longer becomes a British citizen. But that negates the fact that British citizens commit heinous crimes abroad all the time. They are not stripped of their British citizenship. They're usually punished under the eyes of the law, and I think many people, legal observers, would argue that that's what should have happened to Shamima Begum.
All right. Do you think that the British state, perhaps, is trying to wash their hands off Shamima Begum and not trying to understand instead the reasons why a child born and raised in the UK, as you mentioned, could be radicalized enough to go and join a terrorist group halfway around the world?
Yes, certainly. I mean, she was groomed in the UK. Her school was notified. The British police knew what was happening, yet very little action was taken. And now, ultimately, many people are arguing that she has to take responsibility for her actions, but so should the British state in their failure to protect this young girl who left at the age of 15 to join Daesh. And that, yes, she should be punished. Yes, she should face the heavy hand of the law if she's found to have broken laws. But she should do that as a British citizen, because she committed those crimes as a British citizen. She was born and raised in the UK, and under international law, you cannot classify someone as stateless. And Bangladesh has stated very clearly that she's not a Bengali citizen.
She indeed is not. And also, that called into question the efficacy of the controversial so-called PREVENT program as well.
For sure, because if there are radicalization signs, then how could a 15-year-old get a passport and travel to a war zone? It shows that the PREVENT system or program isn't fit for purpose, and it isn't actually doing the very thing that it's designed to do, which is to stop the radicalization of young people and people in general in the UK. And I think there needs to be a further discussion about the role of the British state in supporting Takfiri militant groups in Syria, which has meant that there is a relatively low conviction rate for when these fighters come back. And that's the real issue. They're worried that the if Shamima Begum does return back to the UK, it's going to be very difficult to convict her while the UK has supported similar groups in Syria to overthrow Bashar al-Assad.
All right, thanks for your insight into the story, Ahmed Cabello there. Thank you. Moving on now. One person has died and four others have been wounded in a U.S. military air raid against anti-terror forces operating on the Iraqi-Syria border. The attack took place in the early hours of the morning in eastern Syria against Iraq's popular mobilization units, who have been fighting against the Takfiri Daesh terror group. Washington said that U.S. President Biden authorized the strikes in an attempt to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. Russia has condemned the attack, which was the first of its kind under President Biden, labeling it dangerous and illegal. Staying with the Biden administration, it has said it'll soon reveal details of how it will take action against those responsible for the murder of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
He'd been very clear that the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, it was a horrific crime. That, of course, is going to be at the center of the report that we have been speaking to. This was enshrined in legislation that the administration should provide an unclassified version of the report to Congress.
The news comes days after The Guardian reported that U.S. President Joe Biden plans to release an unclassified intelligence report that will likely incriminate Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the brutal killing of Khashoggi. The long-awaited report is expected to strain U.S.-Saudi ties. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell has urged world leaders to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
I am convinced, as coordinator of the JCPOA, that we do have a diplomatic space, a diplomatic window of opportunity to dialogue at this moment and to reinvigorate this deal according with the wish explained and expressed by the new Biden administration. We need to use this opportunity and focus on solutions to bring the JCPOA back on track in order for everybody fulfilling their commitments. This is an occasion that we cannot miss.
Mr. Borrell was speaking at an EU meeting held in Brussels, which was attended by European leaders and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. His comments come just days after Iran said that it would comply with its full JCPOA requirements once all signatories to the agreement show strict compliance as well. Greece and Austria are urging other EU states to adopt coronavirus vaccination passports, which they claim will help revive the struggling tourism industry whilst preventing the spread of the coronavirus. Leaders of the EU's 27 countries met online Thursday to start a two-day summit to discuss the ongoing pandemic and vaccination certificates. If approved, the vaccination passport would allow people who have been vaccinated with both jabs to travel within EU member states. In Greece, where tourism contributes to 25% of the annual GDP, global COVID-19 lockdown restrictions have destroyed the economy. Back in this country, Queen Elizabeth II of Britain has encouraged people living in the UK to, quote, think of others and get vaccinated against the coronavirus.
I think the other thing is that it is obviously difficult for people to, if they've never had a vaccine, because they ought to think about other people rather than themselves.
Her comments come after statistics reveal that 11 to 15% of British people were reluctant to get the COVID-19 vaccine, with many citing lack of trust in the authorities. So far, the UK has given more than 18 million people a first vaccine dose, with the government stating it plans to inoculate the rest of the population with their first jab by the summer. Over to Scotland now, where former First Minister Alex Salmond says the country's leadership has acted illegally and must be held to account. Today, he testified in Holyrood with inquiry into the SNP government's botched investigation of sexual harassment claims made against him. Mr. Salmond claims in its inquiry, the committee was systematically deprived of the evidence. He was later acquitted of 13 charges of sexual assault and awarded a payout of upwards of £500,000. But he says Nicola Sturgeon's government must explain why the case was handled so poorly. Have a listen.
The independence of the Crown Office as acting in the public interest matters. Acting in accordance with legal advice matters. Concealing evidence from the courts matters. The duty of candour of public authorities matters. Democratic accountability through Parliament matters.
As there is not a shred of evidence that there was a conspiracy against Mr. Salmond and denies lying to Parliament. She is scheduled to appear before the committee to give evidence next Wednesday, and we'll be sure to cover that for you. To Italy now. The country has, for the first time in over 6 weeks, recorded its highest daily toll of COVID-19 cases. On Wednesday, Italy registered nearly 16,500 coronavirus cases, raising the country's known total cases to over 2.8 million. Thus far, the country has recorded nearly 97,000 deaths, the highest in Europe after the UK. The news comes just a day. Italian Health Minister Roberta Speranza announced that the country will not be relaxing its strict COVID-19 restrictions until at least April the 6th.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, as we have been discussing, he has been president for just over a month, and Joe Biden has now ordered the first military strike of his presidency on, quote, Iranian-backed militia. Now, Washington claims the strike is a response to rocket attacks on U.S. forces in the region in the past 2 weeks. Joining me now to discuss all that, Richard Sudan. And Richard, bring us your take on that story.
I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary in many ways. You know, the sort of press releases and the talking points that are coming out of the Pentagon and Washington are framing this as some kind of retaliatory response, when I think, honestly, most sort of critical thinkers and serious political analysts understand that the United States is the most serious provocateur of violence in the region, not just in recent years, but actually over many, many decades. The US has committed so many violations of sovereignty, so many violations of human rights, and so many war crimes, according to experts, that probably even the most serious mathematicians are probably struggling to keep count. And I think this is just kind of the latest in that series. And I think, you know, the other thing is, let's not forget, you had kind of many liberal pundits and many kind of media outlets across the world really kind of hailing President Joe Biden as some kind of libertarian. Many were making much of his so-called change in rhetoric, this kind of diplomatic tone that he was striking. And I think many people are now just going to see this as business as usual from the United States. You know, the United States' aggressive policy towards Syria and many other areas in the region simply is not going to change with the change of political, you know, office in the Oval Office. And I think, you know, these airstrikes are kind of just underscoring that reality. But I'm afraid I really don't see these as being the last, you know, airstrikes. These have been talked about as the first. And we're literally weeks, you know, into Joe Biden's presidency. So I think hopefully a lot of people would now kind of see the political reality for what it is. And I think also it's interesting that the United States, as it always does, has sought to blame Iran, when most serious observers of Middle Eastern politics actually review the Islamic Republic of Iran as having a massively stabilizing, you know, influence in the region. And were it not for
two things to be pointed out here. Number one, Iran denied any involvement in any attack on the U.S. forces that the Americans claim that happened recently. And secondly, it's always been the position of Iran that U.S. and by extension Western military interference in the Middle East region does not really lead to stability. And we have seen over the past decade, two decades I would say, and not even mentioning what happened prior to that, that it's gone from bad to worse. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan are the most recent examples.
Most people would say these are the facts. You know, we've probably lost track of just how many terrorist groups, cells and militias have been unleashed off the back of disastrous, failed, repeated policies from the US, of course, backed with their allies like the United States. But I think the reality is the situation in Syria, the situation in Palestine and all across the region would be vastly different were it not for the stabilizing influence of Iran, which is actually welcomed and celebrated by many. So I think actually many people really see the claim by the US and the US government that Iran is somehow to blame for this as actually ludicrous. You know, the facts speak for themselves. Iran has not been involved in any wars against anybody, but it's the United States that is continually making excuse after excuse to go into other people's countries. Many people would say primarily to get resources. And of course, let's not forget that, you know, the arms industry, the war industry is a massive, massive industry which rakes in billions and billions of dollars in profit each year. And so, you know, observers would say the United States needs to keep making excuses for meddling in other countries. And in this case, we're talking about airstrikes in Syria. But, you know, Saeed, I think more and more people are starting really to cotton on to the kind of reality of the situation.
Bring us some of the reaction to this story online.
And there have been many. Let's go first to Danny, who says, Biden has bombed Syria, blaming it on an Iranian-backed militia targeting military hardware in Iraq. Could it be that the people of the region want the U.S. occupiers to leave? Biden's rule will be riddled with war crimes, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. Birthday Sprinkle says President Biden bombed Syria before Americans got COVID relief payments, and it's not even surprising. And Tanner Jones tweeted, Joe Biden just bombed Syria, So I think now is a good time to say again that the US should not be in the Middle East at all. And there's many reactions like this online at the moment, Saeed.
All right, Richard, let's move on to your second story. And while we're still in Syria, we're going to revisit a story I discussed with Ahmed Caballo earlier on in the broadcast. Tell us how social media users have reacted to today's ruling by the British Supreme Court on the case of Shamima Begum.
Well, I think it's really hard to overstate the significance of this case, which really isn't about Shamima Begum herself. This is about a much wider issue. And I think one of the primary points here for many people is that, you know, Britain calls itself a democracy. Many people say it's the kind of mother of democracies. But Shamima Begum was basically tried in the media and by right-wing populism before she even had a day in court. Now, no one is saying that Shamima Begum shouldn't be held accountable for her actions. But, you know, the United Kingdom, and again, this is not me, this is legal observers and legal experts saying this, the United Kingdom cannot simply render people stateless for politically expedient reasons. It simply cannot be the case. Now, I dare say this decision will probably be appealed, but I think what's astonishing for a lot of people is that the justification given for this is that Shamima Begum somehow presents a national security threat. This is a 21-year-old woman who left the country when she was 15 years old. It's not like she went to join Daesh as a fighter. She married a Daesh fighter, and I think it's ridiculous that she now constitutes some kind of serious threat to national security when we see many other umpteen examples of people that have been involved in wars involving terrorism, people would say. And not only that, I think year after year, the United Kingdom basically rolls out the red carpet to all sorts of arms dealers involved in very real war crimes abroad. And actually other leaders, for example, the Israeli leaders are welcomed here, you know, with red carpet. So I think this is really about a much wider issue, much wider, way beyond Shamima Begum. And as I think Ahmed Caballo said, this certainly sets a dangerous precedent. But again, a lot of legal experts are basically agreeing with that point. And
Richard,
I think
let me get your opinion on this point briefly as well. Some are calling this ruling, this whole treatment of Shamima Begum, as a cynical distraction from a failed counterterror strategy. Very briefly, what do you think of that?
Well, I think even if it isn't a direct ploy to do that, it will certainly have that effect. And by the way, it won't just divert attention from a failed, a foreign policy strategy. It will divert from a whole host of other problems in the United Kingdom. But I think one of the points here is everyone's focusing on Shamima Begum. I think many more people are actually saying, look, what is the UK's role, or what was the UK's role in actually bringing about the emergence of Daesh? Many people are saying that the United Kingdom and her allies, through failed foreign policies, have created the fertile breeding ground which allows terror groups like Daesh to flourish. And so if that hadn't happened, there would have been no Daesh for Shamima Begum to go to in 2015. So I think
that
all of this really diverts responsibility
point,
from the United Kingdom.
Indeed. Let's hear from people out there who have been watching this story.
So Trevor tweets, Andrew Mitchell, the journalist, is correct. Of course, Shamima Begum and the other British nationals should be returned to the UK and their citizenship restored. They are nationals and should be tried in the UK. Gary Young, the journalist, tweets an old article of his on the subject, which says, the notion that Britain could not handle Shamima Begum, could not show her a better future, could not try her, convict her, reorient her or support her, is worse than pathetic. And Dragon Sweet, Shamima Begum was an actual child when she was groomed and radicalized. The decision to strip her of her citizenship is so wrong, and I wonder how different it would be if she was white. And Dragon's not the only person to make that final point there, Saeed.
All right, Richard Sudan. Richard, thanks for all that. Our time is literally up. Thanks for joining us again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, attaches a great deal of significance to education among workers. He says, in the current world and with the speedy technological developments, constant education and training and using the previous experience is a necessity for productive and working institutions so that economic prosperity increases through strengthening of productivity and quality of production. Please stay with us with a new program in our series, Second Phase of the Revolution, Leap in Production. Stay with us. Academic studies on successful economic models show that development occurs in societies in which, in addition to natural resources and material assets, there are notable human resources too. In other words, the countries that have achieved higher economic growth have better education, better skilled workers, and a more efficient workforce. The top parameter in development of any country is its manpower, which has a remarkable share in the economic, social, and cultural development of the country. Studies on development reveal that government policies, including investment on human resource development and expenses of research and development, have not only been effective on growth and productivity, but also on appropriate distribution of income and reduction of economic inequality. In the postmodern era, human asset is the greatest and most valuable property of every organization and every country. Accordingly, investment in this field, especially in the domain of innovative sciences relating to cyberspace and artificial intelligence, is a strategic necessity due to the fact that these two factors set the ground for exponential growth of production. In view of this, many researchers and experts of management and productivity maintain that a country's access to high level of productivity depends on having organizations and factories that enjoy adequate competitiveness, profitability, and creation of high added value. To create such organizations, it is essential to have skilled workforce and productive personnel. Human asset, in fact, demonstrates the know-how in the minds and thoughts of the personnel, and it is the basic source of innovation and regeneration of an organization, introduces a combination of qualifications, attitude, and creativity of its personnel. Today, the role and importance of manpower is a yardstick in gauging production and offering services. In view of this, human asset or human personnel has gained higher share so that it has created the concept of know-how economy in production of gross domestic product or GDP. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's emphasis on leap in production and manufacturing during the era of maximum sanctions outlines a pleasant perspective of Iran's economy. The only way to exit from current economic woes is to fix the eyes on the interior and use the domestic capacities and capabilities in a synergy of skilled and specialist workforce. Human assets can both transform themselves and develop to modify other parameters. This will result in a permanent, dynamic economy. Alvin Toffler, a pioneer of change and development, says know-how and technology are the key to economic growth. Many countries have attained an important status in the global economy through planning and reliance on domestic resources and implementation of long-term projects based on know-how and technology. Statistics show that Iran ranks third in terms of manpower development. As for economic development, Iran has had a good economic growth, which is manifested in the fields of nanotechnology and knowledge-based companies. Development of technical and professional training plays a vital role in the current state of Iran's economy, because the country's infrastructural investment and increase of tools and equipment without an efficient human workforce will be useless or will be used ineffectively. Technical and professional training requires both development and a mix of know-how, skills and creativity, particularly among a young workforce, the educated youth. Thus, technical and professional universities play a significant role in teaching the necessary skills for the workforce needed in industry, agriculture and the service sector. Today, these universities have a capacity to educate nearly 150,000 students at 174 universities and higher institutions and academic centers. Targeted training of skills as a national strategy plays a key role in achieving economic success, social welfare, boosting creativity and innovation, and bringing about a leap in manufacture and production. This will pave the way for maximum use of capacities in the field of manufacture and production. Moving in this course will result in high and sustainable economic growth and will also assist in solving the problem of unemployment. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution has pointed out, we have many scientists, specialists, knowledge-based firms and innovative persons in the country, and this is amongst the most important economic infrastructure in every country. It means that the most important economic infrastructure for a country is the existence of a highly skilled and trained manpower.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and especially the last of them, Muhammadul Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were speaking about psychological diseases and the psychological problems that we might face in a society, and we said that most of them has to do with our thoughts and the way we think. A prominent scholar by the name of Cronin writes, make a list of the things that you consider the causes of your worries and anxieties. When these causes are down on the paper, you will see that in general most of them are vague and insignificant and unimportant. Most of the time, the balance sheet of our worries and cares appears as follows, he says. 40% of them are such calamities as will never take place. 30% of them relate to the past or the future sorrows, which not even the sympathies of the whole world can alter. 12% of them consist of unfounded fear of loss of health. And 8% may really be causes for worry and anxiety. A realistic examination will lead us further to drop some of these later causes. Then we will see that which we usually fear most only happens rarely in actual reality. So let me repeat that one more time. He says, when we see that which we usually feared about only happens rarely in actual reality. So the troubles of our hearts, our minds, the self-pity, the negative energy, all of those anxieties that we have, which if we had thought control, or if we could control our thoughts to a certain degree, or focus more, or have mindfulness of everything we do in that right moment. For example, when we are washing the dishes, when we are talking, when I'm here talking to you right now on the radio station, I should focus on this. My mind should not fly away to some other places. When your mind starts to fly away, it is then that you start to think those thoughts, those negative thoughts, those self-pities, and so on and so forth. There is only one remedy for the disease of this feeling. What is it? We should bring about such a change in our world that we cease regarding ourselves as its center and axis. That is one way. That we stop thinking about egoism, we stop thinking that we are the center of the world. Rather, we should take others into account and realize the fact that our being is a part of the human society and that our life depends upon and is subject to the welfare of others.
We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Now, another perspective is that you think about those who have a lower rank than you in any field possible. For example, when it comes to welfare, when it comes to poverty, when it comes to being a rich and wealthy person, you don't think about the one who is higher above you. You think and reflect upon the one who has a lower level of wealth or well-being than you. What about them? How are they living their lives? When you think like that, which is actually a description of our deen, our religion, you would feel much better. When you think about other people's misfortune, you will say to yourself that I actually do not have a bad life. I still have two healthy eyes, hands, feet, fingers, and so on and so forth. And these guys, they don't have any of those things. Or when it comes to poverty, I have food on the table. Many people, millions of people, hundreds and millions of people have issues with food. So there are many things that you can think about and concentrate on those who have a lower level. And that will help you when it comes to your thoughts and the negative thoughts that you have. Human society, we are part of it. And that our life depends upon and is subject to the welfare and misfortune of the family, community, nation, and group to which we belong. After these difficulties are finally analyzed and no solution is found, to immerse oneself in sorrow and grief is a kind of faithlessness, for such a despair signifies the absence of faith in the need for God's help. No wisdom, dear brothers and sisters, no wisdom or philosophy, however sublime, however high, can be of any benefit to a man who locks himself in the prison of sorrow and grief. But if we employ wisdom by following the lead of reason, we will be able to elevate our lives to a height beyond the reach of our inner number one enemy and attain a real spiritual peace. Also, when we follow the lead of the prophets and the imams and the great spiritual master scholars, we see that we can feel tranquility. If they have passed these obstacles, then we most surely can pass these obstacles. If this person has been the lowest of the low, but has reached this peak in any field, then most surely we can do it too in a lower level. All of this will help our mental health and spiritual health, inshallah. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh, 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 oh.
Your love is all I need. To be all
I need.
And I know that you see how much you need. You need to me, 'cause your love is all I need. To be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.